From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Each year, billions of dollars of federal money go to scientists across the country working in fields from medicine to physics to the environment. It's your tax dollars that pay for that research, and the results are often used to set policy. Now some lawmakers are saying that the data, not just the published results, all the data should be available to anyone. Some scientists disagree about how the data should be released, or even whether it should be released. Who owns the data that comes from federally funded research? This hour we'll talk about a new law that, if implemented, would make the data from such projects available to everyone. Debating access to research data coming up right after the news, so stay with us.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Former Senator Bob Dole is pressing ethnic Albanian leaders to sign the peace plan for Kosovo as soon as possible. Dole's meetings with the leaders today were held in the capital of Macedonia because the Yugoslav government denied him a visa. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright heads to London tomorrow for talks on the Kosovo crisis amid a flurry of diplomatic activity aimed at getting Serbs and ethnic Albanians to nail down a peace accord within the next 10 days. Sarah Chase has more.
Secretary Albright will meet with British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, who will be back from Moscow, where he urged Russian officials to push Serbia to accept the draft accord. Cook and French Foreign Minister Hubert Védrine issued a statement repeating that a ground implementation force is inseparable from any agreement on Kosovo. They said they expect the parties to come to the second round of talks ready to finalize an accord. Meanwhile, the European Union mediator for the process, Wolfgang Petric, was also pushing on the Serbian side in Belgrade, meeting with Yugoslav Deputy Prime Minister Nikola Sinovic. Petric reportedly told him the political aspects of the agreement might be able to be adjusted somewhat. And former Senator Bob Dole met with Kosovo Albanian leaders, saying he hoped he could persuade them to sign the draft, quote, at the earliest possible time, perhaps even before talks are set to resume on March 15th. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Chase in London.
President Clinton has again nominated Bill Lan Lee to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Lee has held the post on an acting basis since his nomination was rejected by a Senate panel more than a year ago. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, had urged Mr. Clinton not to resubmit the nomination. The World Trade Organization says it will hold an emergency session in Geneva on Monday to intervene in the mounting trade war between the United States and Europe. The European Union called for the meeting to try to head off U.S. economic sanctions. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Paris.
Washington is threatening duties that would force Americans to pay double for everything from Scottish cashmere to French camembert. The move follows a dispute over bananas. The WTO says Europe unfairly favors producers in its former Caribbean colonies at the expense of Latin American companies, some controlled by U.S. firms. The EU has since made changes, and a WTO panel will decide whether to accept them next month. Until then, the EU says sanctions are illegal. WTO member states will consider that argument Monday. The dispute is riling even staunch allies. Britain today summoned the U.S. ambassador for a second time to complain about U.S. bullying. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Paris.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 209 points in heavy trading. And on the Nasdaq, the composite index is up 32. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the surge in stock prices today was triggered in large part by a report from the Labor Department on February unemployment. The jobless rate was up a bit, but 275,000 new jobs were created, and there were no signs of wage-related inflationary pressures that might prompt the Federal Reserve to consider raising interest rates. Bell South is turning to the federal courts to try to overturn an order that it pay millions of dollars to rival companies for Internet dial-up calls. Sid Hoskinson with Peach State Public Radio reports from Atlanta.
Late last month, the Federal Communications Commission ruled that Internet connections are long-distance calls, opening the door for Bell South and other regional phone systems to start charging Internet service providers, or ISPs, for each minute their customers are online. At issue is a rule known as reciprocal compensation. It requires companies connecting to each other's networks to pay a fee for passing along a local call. In terms of the Internet, most of those calls tend to be one way, and that means Bell South is paying out more money than it's making on Internet hookups. In Georgia, the State Public Service Commission has ruled that Internet connections are local phone calls. Bell South currently owes millions of dollars to Internet service providers, and the PSC has ordered the company to pay. Bell South's lawsuit asks a federal judge to overrule the state agency's order. For NPR News, I'm Sid Hoskinson in Atlanta.
Nike is recalling 110,000 pairs of infant shoes called Little Air Jordans. High amounts of lead have been found in the red trim paint on the sneakers. The company has expressed deep regret over the problem, which it blames on erroneous information provided by the paint supplier. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. More than 240 locations across the country and online at www.borders.com.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. At a 1997 hearing, Senator Richard Shelby from Alabama asked the Environmental Protection Agency for data the agency used as a basis for setting strict pollution guidelines. The EPA refused, saying the data belonged to the researchers at Harvard who conducted the air pollution studies. Frustrated, the congressman sponsored a provision in a law passed last year that would make all data used to support policy decisions and all data resulting from federally funded research, all that data, everything available to the public under the existing Freedom of Information Act. Many scientists are now up in arms about the new law, saying it could compromise the privacy of research subjects and university-industry relations, and that the specifics of the law haven't been clearly outlined. Some observers are saying, on the other hand, that if public money is used for the research, why shouldn't the public be allowed to see it and use it? This hour, we'll hear from advocates on both sides of the issue debating whether and how federally funded research data should be made available to the public. And if you'd like to talk about it, you're more than welcome to join our conversation. The number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you're invited to surf over to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find all the links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guests. Kathy Casey is the legislative director in Washington for Senator Richard Shelby, a Republican from Alabama, and she joins us today from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Mark Frankel is the director of the Program on Scientific Freedom, Responsibility, and Law at the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington. He's also in our NPR studios. Welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You're welcome. Mary Ellen Sheridan is the Assistant Vice President for Research at the University of Chicago in Illinois, and she joins us today from Idaho. Thank you, and welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time out from your vacation, I understand.
Thank you, Ira. I'm pleased to be able to participate this morning.
You're welcome. Let me begin, Kathy Casey, with you. It was your boss who sponsored this law. Why did you feel you needed to have this?
Well, the senator sponsored this particular provision within the Treasury and General Government Appropriations Bill last year because of an interest that he had developed in previous years. And as you noted in your introduction, the senator had a very strong practical experience with the question of the public having access to federally funded research. And in this case, federally funded research in this case that actually underlied a particular federal rule, which was highly controversial. Mm-hmm. A year prior to his efforts on the appropriations bill that passed last year, the senator participated in a hearing where Administrator Browner from the EPA testified, and she was testifying regarding the ozone and particulate matter rules, which had recently been promulgated by the EPA. These rules at the time were highly controversial. Many concerns had been raised about the scientific basis that had been used to underlie the rule, and there are also significant questions about costs, which varied from anywhere from $500 million to $60 billion, according to the Council on Economic Advisers. So there were some really significant issues that had been raised about these particular rules and how the EPA came to develop the rules. And within that hearing, the senator had questioned Carol Browner on whether they would make the studies and the data that were used to underlie this rule available to the Congress. And what she stated was that Harvard and also, I believe it was the American Cancer Society, had two of the studies which had been used in promulgating this rule, which my understanding was had taken several years, that the senator could ask Harvard for the database that, that had been used to support the study. And he had asked her, well, don't you have that? And she said, no, but you can ask Harvard. And he was very concerned about the fact that there was not any kind of mechanism for the public to have access to the underlying database that was being used to justify these results, which ultimately were used to support this federal rule that affected millions and millions of Americans and would potentially cost billions and billions of dollars. So with that practical experience at hand, I think he thought it was this past year he was interested in seeing about trying to find a way to allow the public reasonable access to federally funded research, and in particular federally funded research and research that is used to underlie federal rules and policies. And that's why last year, with the help of several other senators, he included a provision in a Treasury and General Government Appropriations Bill.
That was that big, giant bill passed at the last minute.
Actually, it was one of 13 appropriations bills that is annually passed. Mm-hmm. What happened was, as early as July of 98, he included a provision in this bill that would have asked OMB to study the current requirements dealing with making federally funded research available to the public, and to consider revising their circular, which is what we ultimately did direct them to do. And in July of 98, they included language asking OMB to study it. Later on, that bill was incorporated into an omnibus bill because they were unable to pass it separately.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the language as early as October and latest September, October had been drafted, included in a separate bill that was ultimately rolled up into the omnibus bill.
But were there any hearings conducted by inviting scientists to comment before Congress on the implications of this?
No, nothing beyond, I would say, the more comprehensive issues where these issues were raised the year before. But within the context of this particular provision, there was no discussion beyond that within the committee beyond the colloquies between the senators and the discussions with the committee staff and OMB in drafting this.
Mm-hmm. Mark Frankel, Mary Ellen Sheridan, what's wrong? What's wrong with allowing everybody to have access to all this data? I would think if we all paid for it, why can't we all see it?
I think that the scientific community would support the objective that access is appropriate and public accountability for taxpayers' dollars is a reasonable expectation. I think the grave reservations from the university research community certainly are that the tool, that FOIA is the wrong tool.
Freedom of Information Act.
Yes, indeed. And that Senator Shelby's intentions are not in question, and that there is a public accountability, that dissemination of new knowledge is what we get the federal funding for, and that university researchers are committed to that. But the mechanism of FOIA...
Well, what's wrong with that mechanism?
Well, for one, FOIA was never intended to be the source of raw underlying data. It governs the actions of public access to records and information held by the federal agencies. Mm-hmm. This reaches through into the laboratories, and the reach through and the ambiguity and uncertainty of what's embraced by that reach is what's causing the anxiety in the community.
You mean there might be private records of, let's say, subjects in the data? You might have videotapes of people themselves that would be violating their privacy, things like that?
And although the Freedom of Information Act was constructed with some exemptions in it, Those exemptions apply once the information would be in the hands of the agencies, and they may or may not be applicable to the research data. For example, if in good faith a university has a partnership with a set of families, and they have promised that set of families that as they videotape information about how the families interact with their children, they've assured them that that information is confidential. Mm-hmm. Now there could be a FOIA request, and the researchers who've had federal funding for their study of family-child interactions wouldn't be able to say, "This we've promised these individuals confidentiality." The determination about how those videotapes would be made available would come after the videotapes are turned over to the federal agency. And I guess that much of the concern of the research community is breach of good faith, and who would we encourage to volunteer from the public for studies in the future if we were only able to tell them that we can't assure you the confidentiality. We no longer have the ability to withhold your private information. We would have to turn it over, and the agencies, whose intentions may be good and honorable, right, they would make that determination. We feel that's a very, potentially quite harmful in the long term to the public good of the value of scientific research.
Mm. Mark Frankel, you wrote an editorial in the journal Science in February 19th issue saying that scientists should speak out about this, urging them to.
Absolutely. I think it's critical to note that we really didn't have an opportunity late last year to have a voice in a matter that clearly has strong implications for the conduct of research. I think that was somewhat of a shortcoming in the process, and I would hope that during the course of 1999 we would have opportunities both in terms of Congress. That is, I'm suggesting that hearings be held on these issues, mm-hmm, and also in terms of the process by which the Office for Management and Budget issues a regulation that would actually implement this legislation. As Dr. Sheridan said, or basically alluded to, the devil is in the detail, and the legislation, which is only two sentences long, basically, is very vague about how things will be designed and how they'll be implemented. So it's very important for the scientific community to keep tabs of what's going on with regard to the efforts by the Office of Management and Budget.
Kathy Casey, how do you react to these criticisms? They sound valid, don't they? Why expose people to unnecessary publicity when they don't expect to, things like that?
One of the reasons why the senator and his colleagues thought that FOIA would be an appropriate mechanism to use to allow the public to gain access to this research is because of the very concerns that have been raised. FOIA has several exceptions which address anything from national security and foreign policy to medical and personal privacy, law enforcement concerns, commercial or financial information, privileged or confidential information, proprietary and trade secret information. The senator and his colleagues believe that these exceptions are broad and cover many of the kinds of concerns that would be raised by the community about making data available. So understanding the concerns that are being raised, the senator and his colleagues believe that FOIA is a flexible tool that addresses, they're drafted broadly to address the various areas that have been raised, like trade secret and privileged and confidential information, also particularly personnel and medical files that would also constitute possibly an invasion of personal privacy. Those are broad exceptions within FOIA intended to address, we believe, the kinds of concerns that have been raised. And secondarily, on the process, OMB is currently put out a revision to their circular, which everybody now, including the scientific community and others, which we would encourage as much as possible to participate in this process, has an open comment period on their proposed revision until April 5th of this year. And I think that anybody who would have a particular view about the sufficiency or insufficiency of the FOIA exceptions or other issues, as Dr. Sheridan has raised, should participate in this process and submit formal comments so that OMB can consider them when they work toward putting together a final rule.
But in fact, there is a House bill, H.R. 88, that's been submitted by Congressman Brown of California to basically pull out the old language, isn't it, to to amend the Treasury and General Government Appropriations Act to repeal the requirement regarding data produced under federal grants, goes on another half a sentence.
Right. I'm aware of that bill. I think the senator's view is that OMB has come forward with a rule to achieve the objectives, which, as Dr. Sheridan and possibly Mr. Frankel have also agreed, are laudable goals. We believe that the OMB process is the best forum at this time to be able to take the varied comments and concerns and address them within the context of putting together a revision. Right now, the comment period is still, it's still early on in the comment period. You have until April 5th to do so. And we believe that OMB will be in a good position to address many of these concerns. And if it is the case that there were particular issues that they were unable to address, I think that when they do come forward with some sort of response to the comments, that they're going to lay that out. But the process is proceeding. I think end-running it now, when everybody agrees that the objectives are worthy, would be unfortunate and a step backward rather than forward.
Mark Frankel?
Well, I'm not sure that looking to Congress for some meaningful discussion of the issues would be an end run around the OMB process. I mean, the OMB process must go forward, but even the OMB admitted at a briefing that AAAS hosted last Friday on the issue that basically they're between a rock and a hard place. Their hands are somewhat tied in terms of how they interpret that piece of legislation that was passed last year. So there's only so far that they're going to be able to go to respond to the concerns of the scientific community. It seems to me that we can also have a parallel track where we are discussing these issues openly in the halls of Congress, and AAAS sees H.R. 88 at least as a basis for holding hearings and making sure that Congress is aware of the concerns that we have and having that aired in an open forum, whereas the OMB process, although ultimately comments will be made available to the public, clearly it doesn't have the visibility that a congressional hearing or two would have, and I think we would be delighted if Congress was willing to open up the process a little bit at the same time that we're also responding to the OMB proposal.
And I think that the OMB process is presumptive that Freedom of Information Act is the way to go. And I think that the alternatives that might come forward if there were open hearings and community involvement from the researchers, from those other public interest and commercial groups that I would like to access underlying data, that there are other mechanisms that can and should be found.
Have you got a suggestion of what could take place of this?
Well, I think there are data sharing policies that have been used within disciplines. The Human Genome Project has a data sharing policy. Crystallographers have long had data sharing policies, and I think that where the scientific community has not been as proactive as it can and it should be, is to step forward to work with the federal funding agencies to articulate data sharing and access that addresses the type of data that are appropriately shared with the public. Not all data, and I think the public concern should be that data in and of themselves don't equal understanding, they don't equal good science. We're quite concerned that preliminary data could be very harmful. And I liken that to saying that you have a perhaps 5,000 to 10,000 piece jigsaw puzzle, and a FOIA inquiry comes in at an early stage because you couldn't tell when they would ask for information.
Especially
it may
in
give
this.
Give you 200 pieces of a puzzle.
Yeah.
200 pieces may not represent anything that's meaningful or useful to the public.
We're talking about protecting the rights of data and public access to it this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. I've been thinking about this, and if everything were open to the public, and now in this world of all these talk shows and whatever, stuff, data coming out of that's gained from Freedom of Information Act showing up on all these tabloid shows in the middle of research, this is like a mind-boggling thought of stuff just starting to show up on the tube every night.
Well, it's because data does not mean understanding. You know, the cost of Xeroxing lab books and videotapes and software and large-scale databases, raw underlying data is not going to be very meaningful unless you have people, and there are people outside of the academic research laboratories, who are capable of interpreting what the intention of the research project was, what its underlying hypotheses were, and that's one of the reasons why the scientific community is quite concerned. There's mischief.
If I could just say something. One, I wanted to be clear about my comment regarding H.R. 88, the bill that you mentioned. I think that the more hearings, the better. The more discussion there is about this issue, the more sunshine on it, the more discourse, I think, only informs everybody more. I guess my concern was that the H.R. 88 would attempt to stop OMB's process from going forward. I think if House hearings are a complement to the OMB process, then that's wonderful, and I think that can only add value to the process ultimately. As a secondary matter, I think that I understand some of the issues that have been raised about releasing preliminary data, and that the public may not know what to do with it. They'll misuse it. They'll create mischief. I think that the senator's view would largely be that that he'd give more credit to the public, and particularly in the case where you have federal rules and policies that affect their lives and the laws that they live under, that they should have a right to know that there is a good, sound scientific basis for it. Mm-hmm. Because if there is a lack of access to it or a belief that they just have to be told that it's good for them, then that breeds a mistrust in government, and it undermines the very rules that they're told that they must live by. So we think that there's a value there. And I don't think that we think that these two goals have to, or these issues have to be mutually exclusive. I think that some of the concerns that have been raised about data and when it would be made available and how it would be made available are issues that are going to be addressed within this process. But I think that ultimately that the public is not as stupid as many people would like to almost characterize that they would be in gaining access to this data and being able to understand it.
Go ahead, quickly.
Ira, I don't think it's a matter of suggesting that the public is stupid. I think one would have to say that even scientists in other fields don't necessarily understand raw data in another field. They also need documentation, interpretation to help them make sense of it. I think the point that I would make is that there will be a deluge of data into the public arena, and we have to think about the implications of that for science and public understanding in weighing the cost and benefits associated with this legislation. It's simply just another factor that needs to be taken into account.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Jerry in Flushing, Queens. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, hello. Very interesting. The thing that I wanted to ask Senator Shelby's representative was this. Is it very vital, and I think it is, that people's privacy not be taken and put into the public domain?
Oh, Jerry, I think absolutely. One of the reasons why the senator and his colleagues felt that FOIA would be a good mechanism is because of the very strong exception, the senator believes, strong and broad exception that currently exists for information that and files and data that would constitute a clearly unwarranted invasion of personal privacy, and that includes medical files and medical information.
All right.
So absolutely.
And so when you get when you request a FOIA file, you just don't blanketly get it. They weed in and out the objects they think that should be in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But the determination is done by the federal agency, which means that the confidentiality promise that the scientific researcher has made to the public in the course of asking them to be a volunteer in the project has already been breached, because the transfer of the underlying data means that the transfer of information is then in the hands of the federal government. So that's one of the reasons why we believe that freedom of information is not the way to go about it, because we promise the volunteers who participate in trials that we will keep their information confidential. The determination of what's kept confidential, going from the agency to the public, mm-hmm. is totally in the hands of the federal agency under Freedom of Information Act.
One quick jump in here to remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. Yes, go ahead, Kathy. You want to
Dr. Sheridan, I also just wanted to be clear, I think that I understand the point that you're making. My understanding of the current law is that the federal government, now, it would be for a federal purpose. There is no current provision that allows the public to use FOIA or any other mechanism to require a federal agency to seek information or data that might be awarded under a particular agreement or grant, but that the federal government, the federal agencies that do award these grants and agreements currently have that ability to seek that information, albeit for a federal purpose. So I guess my question would be, don't they currently have that ability, even if they have not exercised it, to seek that information?
I can tell you in 25 years in research in the university environment, they have rarely ever asked for the underlying data, and we have the opportunity to say we have possession of that data and we can redact what we think is appropriate. They can come in and ask for it. The Food and Drug Administration always has the ability to come in and assess your clinical research data, but the Senator Shelby's statute is very, very sweeping, and it opens up all kinds of data that is not covered in the exceptions. Those were not ever intended to cover the underlying data held by the scientists in the grantee organizations.
So I guess the question would be, because we felt that we were actually putting an additional safeguard in terms of actually giving an explicit exception for medical and personal privacy that's contained within FOIA that the federal government currently does not have to abide by.
There's no exception in there for organizations or institutions. The exception is medical records and individual privacy.
Right.
It's not clear that biomedical research data, which oftentimes is not held in a medical record, would be accessible under this exception. And I think that there would be a lot of legal time invested in challenges to interpretation of the exceptions.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more with my guests, Dr. Mary Ellen Sheridan, Mark Frankel, and Kathy Casey, about this very interesting and timely issue about who owns all the data that's federally funded and who should be able to see it, and legislation that's in Congress, and legislation that laws that are there, and legislation that's pending. It's all up for grabs, so stay with us. We'll talk lots more about it. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Special funding for Talk of the Nation Science Friday comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting education and research in science, math, and technology, and from the Toyota USA Foundation in support of Science Friday Kids Connection. Additional support for National Public Radio comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the past, only tangible items could receive a patent, things like lawnmowers or mousetraps. But now, software code, life forms, medical procedures, and even our own DNA can be patented. Who wins when vital information becomes private property? Is the patent process stifling innovation, or is it the best way to ensure that technology marches on? Join me on the next Science Friday for a discussion on patents and the patenting process on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about a new law that makes federally funded research data available to the public. With my guests, Mark Frankel, Director of the Program on Scientific Freedom, Responsibility, and the Law at the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington, Dr. Mary Ellen Sheridan, Assistant Vice President for Research at the University of Chicago, and Kathy Casey, Legislative Director in Washington for Senator Richard Shelby, Republican from Alabama. And our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Raymond in Hanalei, Hawaii, is it?
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Seems to me this whole thing would not have happened if in the beginning Carol Browner had agreed to turn over to the senator the Harvard report by declining to do so and asking the senator to go to Harvard directly is what initiated this whole process. I'm sure that Carol Browner, in using the Harvard report, was not dealing with raw data, but was a finished product. And why shouldn't she have just done that and avoided all of this commotion here?
Mark Frankel, you got a comment on that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly hard to speak for Carol Browner in terms of what she was thinking at that time. But, of course, while she did have the Harvard report, she has a scientific advisory committee to help her evaluate the data. But clearly the tradition of the relationship between the agency and the university has been to interpret the laws as indicating that the data produced by the local institution, the university, belongs to that local institution, university, and the agencies, as Dr. Sheridan indicated, are not quick to jump in and intervene to ask for that data in order to protect that tradition, which I think is soundly based and, in fact, has even been reinforced by a Supreme Court decision. So I suspect she had that and perhaps other things in mind, too, in responding to that request.
Okay, Raymond?
Well, as I understood it, the report in question was not one that contained raw data, but was a finished product of whatever research went on at Harvard. And it seems to me there's no reason why that report, which is really a public report and it's in the public domain, could not have been handed over to the senator at that time.
All right, Raymond, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Ken in Anchorage. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I'm a professional anthropologist and archaeologist, and myself and my colleagues are very concerned by this last action because we think that the senator had a specific object in mind and yet used such a broad brush that it could very seriously affect the kind of things we do. Our interpretation of this new law, unless it's, and we're pushing very hard for it to be changed, unless it's modified, could very seriously affect such things as the confidentiality of the location of archaeological sites, which we know have been pursued through the public agencies by looters and people who want to pot hunt, which is against the law. There were previous exceptions built into the law, into the Freedom of Information Act, the National Historic Preservation Act, into NEPA and several others, in order to try to protect this data. And I work for a federal agency, and I know that we request that kind of data when we pay for studies and so forth. So that's one side of the cultural resource, very specific locational data, not raw research data, but with the senator's law or amendment, there's some serious doubt that those protections could still be maintained. The second thing, it's also cultural resources, where you have an informant to tell you about, working like in subsistence in national parks or something like that. It's extremely difficult to get people, not just for medical research, but to talk about their lives, traditions, cultures, and actions if you cannot guarantee their anonymity. So what I'm saying, to put it very briefly here, is aspects of federal research is not just biomedical, but it's like all kinds of cultural research and archaeological and so forth that need to be considered by Senator Shelby, or H.R. 88 specifically addresses correcting Senator Shelby's actions in order to reemphasize or reinstitute those protections that have been wiped out by the current action.
Any comment, Kathy Casey?
Yeah, again, I think I would just reemphasize the belief that the current FOIA exceptions are very broad. And with the in the absence of more specific, I mean, I know we hear a lot about general concerns about it might not cover this and it might not cover that, even though there are specific exceptions within FOIA to ideally address those concerns. I think we're sort of at a disadvantage to understand how these specific circumstances would somehow be different than they have been in the past in terms of practice when you've had circumstances. I mean, they're targeted at these kinds of issues, we believe, generally. Mm-hmm. So in the absence of more specific instances where FOIA would not work, some evidence that FOIA would not work, it's hard to argue that FOIA isn't intended or would not address those kinds of mm-hmm. those kinds of areas. And again, I think that what I would say is that through the context of the OMB process, when they do respond to a lot of the comments that are raised, I think it'll be instructive to get a sense of the nature of more specific issues where the belief is that FOIA does not address them. And if that's the case, then I think then that's a separate issue than where we are right now. But I think the belief is that FOIA was drafted to address a lot of these issues: national security, medical privacy, personal privacy, confidentiality, trade secrets, commercial and financial information, and that those kinds of broad exceptions should apply even to in different circumstances like mm-hmm. these circumstances.
You know, I'm thinking of in all practicality here of going ahead with this. I'm trying to write down a couple of figures. How many billions of dollars in research? There's like $60 billion of the NSF funds or something like that.
Right.
Do you have to create a whole bureaucracy just to handle all of the requests that wouldn't it even cost more than your agency has now and to handle all the people who would now want information from tens of billions of dollars of research to go sift through this and then judge which should be released, which should not be released, which has the exemptions, which doesn't have the exemptions? You'd have to make a whole building in Washington, I would think,
Add to your calculation, Ira, the parallel activity that would be going on in the research community back in the university to assure that the data that needed to be turned over to the agency was in a reasonable state, that it had whatever appropriate documentation and context with it, so that it wasn't just a data dump.
Do you hand somebody a Petri dish out of the freezer? I mean, if you're asking for that original data, or, I mean, how far do you ask for the paperwork? Do you ask for the tissue sample? Do you ask for, you know, who's going to ensure that the data is transported correctly, that it's kept fresh, that you don't accuse them of being, you know, negligent in how they handle it, things like that?
I think those are all really legitimate issues, but it's important to put them in the context of the broader goal that we're achieving here. If those issues related to the underlying data, if mm-hmm. that kind of data is being used to set a policy that affects almost every American in this country, particularly when you're dealing with public health regulations, I don't think the senator believes that it's unreasonable that if there are questions about the scientific basis for it, that it's important that the public has some sense of confidence that you can validate the data that has been used to underlie this policy.
No question. I'm not questioning the intent. I'm questioning whether the infrastructure was also set up to handle all of these requests.
I think that there is a provision that the senator did include with OMB that provides for cost reimbursement. And if a private party does seek access to data using FOIA, that reasonable costs can be imposed by the agency on that private party for the costs associated with compiling and collecting that information. So we did provide some sort of a cost reimbursement mm-hmm. provision. There had been some questions raised, technical questions raised about whether that would actually transfer down to the institution or university or organization that the data was collected from. And if it's a technical matter, I certainly think that's something that can be addressed because the intent was to ensure that those costs were covered. But as far as the agencies assuming assuming costs associated with complying with FOIA. I think the senator would say that if increasing public knowledge and access to data is a cost that the various agencies would have to assume in order to ensure greater trust in government, then it's a cost worth assuming. And the Congress, who annually does provide funding, billions of dollars in funding for not just research but other programs as well, would be responsible for making that kind of funding available.
Ira, if I may say something, I think it may or may not be a cost to assume. We have to consider that, I think, very carefully. I think what's important is that the bottom line is that I cannot imagine that this legislation could be implemented in such a way that it would not raise the costs of doing research administratively. So the dollars that might go into actual research, which could produce benefits for the public, are going to be put into administrative costs, which may at the very best have an indirect benefit somewhere down the line. I simply would make the case that this is another issue that the public needs to be aware of when weighing the costs and benefits associated with this legislation.
How would you like to see this be debated openly? Do you think that there should be hearings? How would you like to see this resolved as it goes down the road here?
I certainly would like to see congressional hearings, because you have then a public forum which would obviously be covered by the press and word would get out further to the public. I think it would be very useful to consider the possibility, given the complexity of these issues, for the OMB to extend its public comment period beyond April 5th. I think it would also be useful to explore the possibility of having an independent study done about the costs and effects of the possibilities of implementing this particular legislation. We really are engaged in a lot of speculation. Some of it sounds very plausible, but the bottom line is we don't know ultimately what the effects would be. So while we might be supportive of the notion providing more data to the public, as I said earlier, the devil is in the detail, and as you can hear from this conversation so far today, the details remain to be determined. They're very open-ended, and they raise a lot of issues that we need time to consider more thoughtfully.
We're talking about the availability of public data to the public on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Susan in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Go ahead. Thank you.
Well, I have a question, and I guess I need to lay a little groundwork. In 1994, my husband participated in a clinical study at Bethesda, Maryland. After going through several physicians, we were recommended that he participate in a study regarding a heart condition that actually isn't quote-unquote a heart condition, and it's rare.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, we have had good luck with insurance companies understanding exactly what went on. But I personally work in a physician's office and have been for 19 years, and I'm very keen on the release of information to insurance companies. And in light of everything that's kind of come out about, do we want to know whether or not you have a cancer gene, and then your insurance company latches on to that, I would be very concerned if data, if it is not released by the patient, that an insurance company could, in fact, get in touch with a research and find out if the patient has had anything done and what the potential effects of not, being denied insurance because you have participated in a study. We have been lucky, the two insurance companies that we have had since the study in 94, which my husband has a clean bill of health, so I'm sure that has a lot to do with it.
But if he hadn't, you're worried that the insurance company might have declined covering
it.
Yeah.
Right, right. And a lot of them kind of look at us, across that, like, what in the world happened? And then we have a letter that the NIH, which was wonderful, provided for us, but, in order for me to explain exactly what he had,
That's all right. We don't need to know. We get the gist. We get the gist of your question.
I mean, even to the insurance company, I'll say, "Well, I've got a letter. You'll have to read it because I don't understand it myself."
Let me get an answer, Kathy Casey. How could someone be assured that under the FOIA here that they're protected? And let me give you. Let me just take the example that that the senator was using. If the senator is looking for data for a pollution standard, and he wanted to go to the records of people who might be suffering from some smokestack issue that sulfur or something, and he wanted to find all the records of those people who were included in a study, let's just say, how would those people be assured that once that data is released, that these people's records would be secure?
Well, I think his belief is that if you look at the current FOIA exception, there's one in particular that I think that would address the particular issue, and that he would agree that there would be a legitimate privacy reason for not having that kind of information particular to that individual disclosed. But if you look at personnel and medical files and similar files and information, the disclosure of which would constitute an invasion of personal privacy, the senator believes that would specifically address those kinds of concerns. And I know in the past when you do have data sharing, and maybe Dr. Sheridan could talk a little bit about this, whether there are not already current procedures that are used to deal with issues of medical privacy in terms of eliminating identifiers and coding issues that are coding mechanisms that are used to protect that very kind of medical privacy.
And I appreciate, Kathy, you're exactly right. And I think this is where the academic researchers would say that there are mechanisms to properly screen and to keep from public access the confidentiality and the certain privacy. What FOIA doesn't provide to the researchers is the ability to do that with their research that they have already gained. They have to turn that over to the agency, and then the FOIA exemptions kick in. They don't apply to the research that's held by the researcher at the university. They have to turn that information over, and in good faith, probably, they have issued informed consent statements, brought volunteers in, and promised them that their information would be held confidential. But they won't be able to hold it confidential under Senator Shelby's. They have to turn it over to the agency, and then the question comes, which of the exemptions apply, or how would they be interpreted, and how is the data to be protected?
All right, we're
a very serious concern.
We're talking seriously this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. What do you think the outcome? Where does that House bill, Congressman Brown of California, the H.R. 88, which will repeal this provision, where does it sit in Congress now, Mark Frankel? Do you have any idea?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly been introduced. I think Congressman Brown is in the process of trying to gain bipartisan support.
But he's a Democrat in the Republican Congress. So
that's right.
It doesn't look like it's going to go very far.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I think when it comes to science, everyone on the Hill respects the notion of maintaining the integrity of science and gaining the promises of benefits somewhere mm-hmm. down the line. And it's amazing how much bipartisanship you can have in terms of the scientific mm-hmm. issue. So he is in the process of seeking that kind of bipartisan support with the hope that somewhere down the line there will be an opportunity to have some hearings.
All right, let's go to the phones. Bill Kovacs?
Hi, how are you?
Are you with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, first of all, I want to thank both Senator Shelby and Kathy for bringing this very important issue to the public's attention. And one of the things, as I've been listening to the show, that everyone seems to forget is that, you know, business pays about $700 billion a year in regulatory compliance, and about $200 billion of that goes to paperwork. And it virtually discloses all of its information on a daily basis to federal agencies, and we have to trust them with FOIA. And it's really interesting to hear the scientists complain as to why they shouldn't have to do it or the cost of the system, when this is really a right to know. And all we're talking about is if it's taxpayers' funds, there's a reimbursement mechanism, and this is something that we need to know as the agencies impose, you know, tens of billions of dollars of new regulations on the American public. So I'm throwing it out more than anything as to say it's a great debate, and thank you for bringing it to our attention. But it's really something that the business community has dealt with the entire time. And with the cost reimbursement mechanisms, what we're really talking about is the public right to know.
So you're saying to all the scientists, welcome to the crowd now.
I'm saying welcome to the crowd, because now they know when they talk about I've heard statements like, well, raw data can be misleading. Of course it can, but every day the business community sees its raw data disseminated mm-hmm. throughout the world. And now all of a sudden the scientific community is going to be under the same type of scrutiny that everyone else has been under for years. So welcome to the game.
Mary Ellen Sheridan, any comment on that?
Well, I think, but you know, science has had federal funding for the dissemination of new knowledge. That was always the goal and the intention. It's what the scientists and the public have the same interest there. I think the mechanisms that the scientific community has counted on for giving science information to the public through the validation that this is good, solid research, that there are reasonable conclusions, that the data has been properly interpreted, is part of what the public confidence is. And no one is going to advocate supporting bad science or poor science. What we want to do is continue to use the procedures that we're bringing good, solid knowledge to the public. And I would advocate better data sharing policies than Freedom of Information Act.
Kathy Casey, last.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think part of the problem, the reason why we're here, has been the inability and unwillingness of the scientific community over many years to address this and to give the public greater access to give the public greater access to this kind of data and to move forward on data sharing policy. That's part of the reason why we're here, is because of their lack of willingness to do so. So I think that any kind of confidence that we would have that in the absence of congressional action, that the scientific community would, on their own efforts, come forward with some sort of greater data sharing policies. We don't have that much confidence in it.
All right, you have the last word. I want to thank my guest, Kathy Casey, who is the legislative director in Washington for Senator Richard Shelby, a Republican from Alabama, Dr. Mary Ellen Sheridan, assistant vice president for research at the University of Chicago in Illinois, Mark Frankel, director of the Program on Scientific Freedom, Responsibility, and Law at the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington. Thank you all for joining me this hour.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Join Ray and his guests on the next Talk of the Nation in this hour on Monday as they attempt to define compassion and compassionate conservatism and its effect on the 2000 presidential race. Suzanne Mesnick is our technical director. Our audio engineers are William O'Neill and Irene Trudell in New York, Renee Pringle in Washington. Bob Boylan composed our theme music. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, WNYC Radio, 1 Center Street, New York, 10007. And if you missed any of the references we made today, you can always surf over to our webpage at sciencefriday.com, where you can leave email and check out all the links we have to the topics we discuss every hour. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Science Friday is produced by National Public Radio and Samana Productions in association with member station WNYC New York. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. For tapes and transcripts, call toll-free 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-8398.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and LexisNexis, providing decision support information and services to legal, business, and government professionals for more than 25 years. 800-227-4908. Amgen, advancing the frontiers of medicine and improving the lives of patients through biotechnology. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And Hewlett-Packard, providing computer, communications, and measurement products for business, industry, science, healthcare, education, and personal use. This is NPR, National Public Radio.